All right. Yeah. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm going to start today's show with a very special announcement, okay? On November 15th of this year, in Riverside Church in New York City, there is going to be a historic dialogue is going to be taking place, all right? And I want people to check this out. You can go to revcom.us and find out more information about it. The dialogue is titled Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person, all right? That's November 15th at Riverside Church in New York, and there will be ways for people to hook in. Some people can start now. I'm sure you can get to New York City in time, but there's also all kinds of ways that people will be able to listen to it and plug into it all over the country, including a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion. All right, that's November 15th. All right, I also want to make sure that people are hip to September 21st. Tens of thousands of people will be converging in New York City for an unprecedented People's Climate March. Don't forget about that. And that has everything to do with what we're going to be talking about today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Anna Baltzer, national organizer with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, and we'll be talking about the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, all right? So that's at the back end of the show. But opening the show up, we're going to be talking about the recent report from the UN about the climate crisis. And I'm not going to say any more. We're just going to go right into it. Just recently, the latest report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was basically secretly leaked to a number of news organizations. And what it says that runaway growth in the emission of greenhouse gases is swamping all political efforts to deal with the problem, raising the risk of severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts over the coming decades. Here to talk with us about this is Professor Michael Mann. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be with you, Michael.
When we last spoke back in April, we talked about another climate report that had just been issued by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that one itself was pretty alarming. And I understand that this draft report that was just leaked is a synthesis report combining a number of separate previous reports on different aspects of the crisis. Well, what's the difference between these reports in terms of content?
Yeah, so some of it is just sort of technical. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is an organization that operates under the auspices of the UN, but literally represents hundreds of the leading climate scientists around the world who get together and put together these extremely rigorous and comprehensive reports every 5 to 6 years summarizing the state of our scientific understanding of the problem of climate change. And so this is the latest round, the fifth assessment report. And so the way they proceed, they start out with what's called the Working Group 1 report, which is just the basic science. It's the fundamental physical science of climate. What have we learned over the past few years from climate models, from new observations that we compare to the models? What do the models project for the future, given different potential policy pathways that still are in our hands? Depending on what fossil fuel emissions scenarios we pursue, the models can tell us what are the likely changes that result from that. So that's the Working Group 1 report. Then the Working Group 2 report comes out a few months later. It describes projected impacts. If the climate changes in some particular way, what is the impact likely to be on food, on water, on human health, on national security, on our economy, et cetera? And then the final installment of the report, of the three-part report, the Working Group 3 report, is on so-called mitigation, solving climate change. What can we do about this problem technologically, economically? What are the feasible solutions that are available to us to try to mitigate potentially dangerous and irreversible climate change? That's really what the IPCC has been tasked to do back since 1990, when the United Nations Framework Convention first tasked the IPCC to assess, to not prescribe the solutions, but to assess prospects for dangerous human interference with the climate. And so the IPCC has been doing this now for more than 2 decades. The synthesis report is basically just taking all that information from the three different working group reports and summarizing collectively what it all says and what it all means when it comes to contending with the problem of human-caused climate change. And as you noted, the language in this latest synthesis report is quite stark. It's pretty remarkable because this is a very conservative document. The IPCC documents by nature, are conservative documents. They are consensus documents where the final wording has to be agreed upon by hundreds of scientists with differing viewpoints. It's sort of a lowest common denominator in a sense because of that. It often, to some extent, understates the true potential threats because there's a range of viewpoints, and often the IPCC sort of ends up taking a somewhat centrist line between scientists who tell us that climate change is proceeding even faster than we might have guessed, and critics, contrarians, skeptics, who deny that climate change even exists. And so there's still a few of those folks within the scientific community. They have some involvement in the IPCC process. And so that necessarily sort of ends up watering things down a little bit. So if anything, the IPCC is a conservative body. Scientists tend to be conservative. They don't like to stick their necks out, you know, with questionable hypotheses, untested hypotheses, dubious conclusions. Scientists, by their nature, are conservative. And so what's so remarkable in this latest synthesis report is that a conservative body like the IPCC would use the sort of stark language that you were quoting earlier about the fact that we are now contending already with dangerous and potentially irreversible, on human timescales, on timescales that matter to civilization, irreversible changes in our climate that will be increasingly detrimental if we continue with business as usual, which is ongoing reliance on fossil fuels for energy.
Now, tell me this. I was thinking about this study that was done on the state of the oceans a little while ago, and it was really interesting because one of the things they said in doing that is that there had been all these scientists working on separate aspects of what's happening to the ocean.
Right.
And when they all came together, it just blew their minds because it was sort of so evident that basically the situation was much worse than the sum of its
yep.
of its parts, that the whole was much worse than the sum of its parts. So that's Absolutely. Similar to what you're talking about here, right?
Absolutely. You know, scientists, increasingly, we sort of carve off some little niche, some little set of problems that we work on because science has become a huge enterprise. There are thousands of scientists. There's so many things that we are investigating that to really be at the forefront of modern scientific research, unlike back in the 1600s and the 1700s when you had scientists like Joseph Fourier and Sir Rayleigh and these sort of citizen scientists who might end up solving four or five of the biggest problems in science of that century alone. That's not the way it works anymore. Scientists tend to be working on small parts of problems, making incremental progress towards our understanding of the way the world works. That's the nature of sort of the modern scientific discipline. And because of that, the sort of situation you described can easily arise. In the lack of sort of multidisciplinary approaches to looking at problems, when you take a problem like the oceans and you break it up so that you've got marine biologists maybe studying certain aspects of ocean ecology, fish population decline, but you may have geochemists who are studying the impact of ocean acidification. The CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere isn't just warming the planet and changing the climate, it's also acidifying the ocean, which is a major problem. It's already a threat to coral reefs. Literally, they will begin to dissolve. They will not be able to maintain their coral structure as the ocean becomes more acidic. And then you talk to people who study the effect of pollutants on animal life in the ocean. And so what happens is you've got all these different sort of communities of scientists studying different problems. And as you say, you bring them all together, and it may be the first recollection on their part that, hey, we're looking at a bigger problem than we realized, because this isn't just a system that is being stressed by one factor. And we all understand this in the way we live our lives. You know, if one bad thing happens to you over the course of the day, you'll deal with it. A couple bad things, well, it's a bad day. But if everything in your life is going wrong simultaneously, it's devastating. It's the whole is much worse than the sum of the parts. And that's true with living organisms. If they are subject to multiple stresses at the same time, they have far less adaptive capacity than if they're dealing with just a limited number of stresses. So when you hit coral reefs with warmer ocean water, which is causing coral bleaching, you hit them with higher CO2 levels leading to ocean acidification, you hit them with pollutants, effluent that runs off into the coastal regions of the oceans and adversely impacts coral communities. Even ozone depletion has been shown to already have had a negative impact on coral reefs. And so they're being hit by all of these simultaneous insults at once, and it's far more difficult to be resilient. It's far more difficult to adapt to sort of an onslaught of negative impacts. And so we're seeing that. We're seeing that with coral reefs. We're seeing that with Arctic ecosystems, with ecosystems where they're being stressed by climate change, but they're also being stressed by development, overhunting, overfishing, all of these things coming together in sort of a perfect storm that represents a far greater challenge for our environment, for ecosystems, for human civilization. The same thing is true with us. We are dealing with so many simultaneous problems right now. Climate change is just one of them. We're dealing with pollution issues, water pollution. We are dealing with loss of habitat, of biosphere. We are, you know, in essence, like the coral reefs, dealing with simultaneous insults to our environment, and that makes the problem far more of a challenge than if we were just dealing with one thing.
All right, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Michael Mann. Michael is the Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and we're talking about the recently leaked new report, synthesis report, from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, Michael, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, well, there's, you know, this report indicates that there's a series of irreversible ecological and economic catastrophes if something isn't done quick. And I wanted to talk about what some of these things are, these you know, the symptoms of all this, or what's actually happening. What are these marks, these scars on the planet right now, and see if we can just get a deeper understanding of this. So in 2009, countries across the globe set a goal of limiting global warming to about 2 degrees Fahrenheit above current levels. What does this report indicate about how that's going, and what are the consequences of what's happening?
Yeah, so the number typically cited is actually 2 degrees Celsius, so closer to 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit relative to pre-industrial time. But these numbers are somewhat subjective anyways. Even 2 degrees Fahrenheit may very well put us in the danger zone when it comes to impacts on food and water and human health. I mean, we're already seeing significant negative impacts of climate change, especially being felt in regions. People who live in the Arctic are sort of seeing climate change ahead of schedule because of the faster warming taking place there. Island nations, low-lying island nations, Pacific Islanders already dealing with flooding because of global sea level rise. So we're already seeing dangerous climate change. But as we go down this fossil fuel highway, we become subject to potentially more and more dangerous impacts. And you allude to sort of these potential tipping points that we may cross, where, you know, we warm the planet enough that we set in motion some changes that we can't undo. That's the irreversibility that we were talking about. The climate doesn't always behave as smoothly as we might like, which is to say, you can warm the climate enough that instead of seeing just a gradual response, you'll trigger something. That warming will trigger something very sudden and potentially irreversible. And one of the examples that we're dealing with right now is the issue of the potential loss of ice from the major ice sheets, from the West Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet. We think that there is enough ice that is vulnerable to melting and to calving into the ocean from those two continental ice sheets to potentially give us, you know, as much as 10 meters of sea level rise, 30 feet of sea level rise, not out of the question. And we'd be talking about, of course, flooding of the major coastal cities of the world, island nations, large parts of coastal U.S., and Europe. We don't know how long that will take. That's one of the uncertainties is, you know, how long will it take for these large pieces of the ice sheets to collapse and ultimately yield that global sea level rise? And the fact is, there's uncertainty. But the uncertainty in this case isn't necessarily our friend, because we are learning that, to some extent, things are actually proceeding faster than our models told us they should. And that is true if you look at how much melt is occurring during the summer over the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. We saw just a couple of summers ago something we had never seen before. There was melt occurring over the entire continent of Greenland. Everywhere in Greenland, even the northern and most high elevation regions of the Greenland ice sheet, there was melt taking place at the surface. We didn't expect to see that for decades. There have been a sort of a spate of recent studies in the leading journals showing that the West Antarctic ice sheet may be far more vulnerable already than we realized, because it is literally being melted from beneath by the warming ocean. And that warming from beneath is actually destabilizing the ice sheet. It's melting the locations of the ice sheet that were in contact with the bedrock that sort of keep the ice on the land and prevent it from calving into the oceans. Those points of contact now appear to be getting eroded by the warming oceans from underneath. And so we may be already seeing far faster rates of melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet and the associated contribution of that to global sea level rise. And I could go on and on. There are a number of aspects of the climate system where we may pass a point of no return. And we may have done that already, in the sense that we may have warmed the planet now enough that we cannot stop a large part of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet from eventually collapsing and contributing to sea level rise. It may be too late to stop that, but it may still not be too late to prevent other things. And so the lesson here is that there's no one tipping point. It isn't like we warm the planet 2 degrees C. If we can't prevent a warming of more than 2 degrees C, we just give up. That's not the way it works. If we don't achieve a 2 degrees Celsius stabilization, we still want to achieve 2.5 degrees. And if we miss 2.5, we still want to stabilize below 3 degrees C, because the more we warm the planet, the more we change the climate, the more likely it is that we see more and more of these potentially irreversible and truly catastrophic changes in our climate unfold.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Now, tell me something. I mean, just out of curiosity here, is they're talking about that there could be ice-free summers in the Arctic in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, and it's another example. If you look at the climate models, what the climate models have been telling us in general is that at current rates of warming, ongoing fossil fuel burning, sort of business as usual fossil fuel burning, if we follow that scenario into the future, that we would potentially see ice-free summers in the Arctic at the end of the century. Well, guess what? We're already almost there. So it turns out that the observations show that Arctic sea ice, summer Arctic sea ice, has been declining far faster than the climate models predicted it to. And we're still trying to figure out exactly why that is. What might be missing from the models that is preventing them from capturing, for example, the dramatic loss in 2012, where the Arctic sea ice had dropped to less than 50% of what it was just a couple decades ago. We're already pretty close now to ice-free conditions at the end of the summer in the Arctic. And if you just sort of extrapolate the current trajectory, it really looks like we'll be there, you know, in a matter of a decade or two, ice-free Arctic at the end of the summer, something the models say shouldn't happen for many decades. And it isn't just academic. It isn't just a scientific curiosity, because as goes Arctic sea ice, goes the populations of polar bears that rely on that environment. So this iconic species, the polar bear, is now established as a threatened species by the U.S. government because we are literally destroying its environment. We're melting the sea ice environment that it requires for its hunting. And that's just one example. I mean, if we lose that Arctic sea ice, then we fundamentally lose an entire unique set of ecosystems that rely on that environment. The Arctic ecosystems, polar bears and walruses that rely on that environment, and all the other animals and plants that are part of that system. If we melt the Arctic, we lose a unique ecosystem that won't be replaced.
You know, and that does emphasize this whole point about the interconnectedness of this all. And I wanted to raise something else in relation to this point in particular. Well, not the loss of this unique ecological setup in the Arctic, but something related to the sort of connectedness of all these problems. When we spoke last spring, we talked about what people were postulating then as a possibility, which was that as these ice sheets melt, that there's organic material that has been frozen over for a long time that becomes exposed and begins to rot, and that there's the possibility of the release of really large amounts of methane, and that can have very dire and different consequences in a certain sense to the atmosphere, to the climate. And that apparently just recently they have actually discovered the release of some methane in that Antarctic region.
Yeah, and so what one of the things that you know we've known for some time is that there's a large amount of methane that exists in a frozen form, either in the permafrost, the Arctic tundra as permafrost in the ground, or along the coastal shelves of the oceans. And it's stable at certain temperatures and pressures. That methane is stable in sort of a crystalline form. But if you warm the coastal shelves or you warm the permafrost even a little bit, you can potentially destabilize all that methane that was frozen. And methane, as it turns out, is an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. On timescales of a couple decades, it's 100 times, almost 100 times as potent as CO2. Over a time frame of a century, it's about 30 times as potent as CO2. So there's been this worry. This is another one of these potential surprises, these potential tipping points, something that can be triggered that we didn't really fully account for, that the models don't really account for. If we warm the climate and we stabilize that methane, then suddenly we get even more warming because we're putting all of this methane greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. It's another of what we call a positive feedback, which sounds like a good thing, but a positive feedback in this sense is a bad thing. It's an amplifying factor. It means we get even more warming than we otherwise would have. So the sort of $24,000 question then is how much of this methane really is sort of close enough to the point of destabilization where it could be released on a massive scale in a short period of time in such a way that it would substantially aggravate the climate change problem, the problem of global warming. And there is a debate within the scientific community. It's important to recognize that there isn't a consensus yet among scientists that this methane feedback problem is a major problem. If you talk to experts in this field, some of them will point to the fact that we are observing methane being released from coastal shelf environments. There was a crater that opened up recently in the Siberian permafrost that we believe was a huge belch of methane being released into the atmosphere as the ground, as the permafrost is warming. But if you do the math, and you calculate how much of it that we're seeing, it's not yet to the point where it's a serious competitor with the warming influence of the CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere with fossil fuel burning. So it's something to keep an eye on, and it could potentially be another one of those aggravating factors that kicks in and makes the problem worse than we had originally envisioned. But at this point, it's potentially a distraction from really the fundamental source of the problem, which is our ongoing burning of fossil fuels and the increase in CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere.
We're talking with Michael Mann, professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the latest report from the UN Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change. Now, the report indicates that if nothing is done, then the effects of climate change will be irreversible. And related to that, it says that even if we act now, there's a risk of abrupt and irreversible changes. And it points to, for instance, the idea that carbon released by burning fossil fuels will stay in the atmosphere and the sea for centuries, even
That's
if
right.
we completely stop emitting CO2 as soon as possible. What does that mean? What's the consequences of it?
Yeah, so, I mean, by some measures, we're already seeing potentially irreversible changes. That appears to be true with the melting of the ice sheets. There's quite a bit of evidence that's mounted now that we have already committed to a substantial loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet. We've passed the point of no return. It isn't like we could cool the climate back down, bring the CO2 levels back down, and drive that process backward. That's not a possibility. It'll proceed no matter what we do. So we may have passed that tipping point. But there, as I alluded to before, there are other tipping points, the collapse of the North Atlantic Ocean circulation. There are all sorts of these potential abrupt changes in climate that could take place, but we don't think we've yet approached the point where those tipping points are a threat. But certain tipping points we've already potentially crossed. And so by that measure, we have already ventured into the realm of irreversible climate change. Now, as you say, the other irreversible aspect of this is just the CO2 that we're putting in the atmosphere. It takes the oceans and ultimately the sediments at the bottom of the ocean, which slowly absorb carbon. It takes these processes thousands of years to play out. So if you put a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere very suddenly, it's going to take the Earth system thousands of years to remove that CO2 from the atmosphere. What that means is that we have already committed to an elevation of CO2 concentrations well above pre-industrial levels for more than 1,000 years. And if you talk to some of my colleagues, like James Hansen, the former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, one of the leading climate scientists in the U.S., Hansen has argued that probably even 350 parts per million CO2, which is where we were several decades ago, even that is too high. If we allowed CO2 to persist even at the level that existed during the late 20th century, that would lock in potentially dangerous climate changes. So we're already too high. Forget about trying to avoid 2 degrees C warming. We've already warmed the climate enough to put in play to allow to unfold some of these more potentially catastrophic changes in our climate. There are scientists who believe that to be the case. And if that's true, if we are already above the sort of safe limit of CO2 in the atmosphere, and the CO2 we put into the atmosphere will take centuries, if not millennia, to come back out of the atmosphere through natural processes, then the implication is that not only do we have to stop fossil fuel burning and other human activities that are elevating CO2 in the atmosphere, we actually have to be implementing technological schemes, if you will, to actually draw CO2 down from the atmosphere, to literally suck the CO2 back out of the atmosphere. And that's an expensive endeavor. It's feasible technologically, but it's expensive to do. And yet, it may be necessary if the expense of not doing that, if the consequences of allowing CO2 levels to prevail at current levels, if that indeed has potentially catastrophic implications, we may have to turn to these technologies, carbon capture and sequestration technology, to literally pull some of the CO2 we've already put into the atmosphere back out of the atmosphere.
We're talking with Michael Mann, professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the latest report from the UN Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change. I have two more questions. One is the droughts. And particularly in California, there's a big question of the drought and the way it's impacting people. But I've also read things like across the Southwest and in New Mexico, they're talking about intense desertification actually beginning to spread. What about this? They said this could all result in a mega drought that's worse than anything in the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, and I saw that article, and whether or not one frames it in terms of mega drought or not, I'm not sure that's the most helpful framing. Frankly, I think a more relevant question is just the average drought conditions in the desert Southwest, the west coast of the U.S. Is climate change making that worse? That's a more basic question.
Yeah.
And the answer seems to be overwhelmingly yes. The California drought, this record drought, not just a record, but it broke previous records by a very large sort of amount. I mean, it's by far the worst drought conditions that California has ever seen. They essentially had to create a new color on the drought map that they use to communicate the deep severity of this current California drought. And we know that climate change contributed to that. We know that climate change is leading to warmer conditions. I mean, California also had near record heat, if not record heat, this summer, at least large parts of California. So you've got this heat, you've got earlier and earlier melting, you've got less accumulation of snow in the winter, earlier snow melt from the mountains, you've got decreasing precipitation in many cases. So it's all sort of coming together, again, in this sort of perfect storm to give us unprecedented levels of drought in California, but also more broadly in the desert southwest of the U.S. And this is something that the climate models have predicted for some time. So what we're seeing happen, the desertification of the desert southwest, is something that the models have predicted, but we're actually learning that it may be worse than we thought. Another example of a surprise, some new aspect of the science that we didn't understand before that's coming into play and is potentially making this problem worse. There have been a number of studies now that suggest that this really odd jet stream pattern we had last winter, where it was extremely dry, relatively warm on the West Coast, and then we had the jet stream sort of crash down into the central U.S. and the East Coast, giving us unusually cold conditions over a large part of the winter. So we had this huge contrast between the West and the East in the shape of the jet stream. The jet stream was basically going north into Alaska rather than traveling through California and Oregon, which normally get all that rainfall in the winter. That was a lot of that was going north into Alaska, and so the rainfall and the snow at higher elevations. So that pattern, that particular pattern of the jet stream that led to those conditions, there are some studies now that suggest that climate change may indeed be favoring that pattern of the jet stream. So the climate models already said that drought was going to get worse in California and the desert Southwest without taking that factor into account. Now with this additional factor, which we saw play out in real time last winter, with the possibility that climate change is having some role in that as well, the problem may be worse. Another example of, yes, there's uncertainty, but look, in many cases, as in this case, uncertainty may be playing out in such a way that the effects are worse or more devastating than we thought they would be. And that may very well be true when it comes to California's ability to meet its water needs. Obviously, this latest drought has been a major threat to water security in California, and that may be, you know, a sign of things to come. It may become the new normal. And if that's the new normal, then places like California have to fundamentally rethink how they are going to find the water resources they need.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Now, one last question. No matter what, it seems large-scale climate shifts are inevitable in one form or another, and their impact is going to be, I mean, a lot of it is known, a lot of it is sort of soon to be or discovered in a certain sense. But you've talked about, and you've mentioned this a number of times, that there are contrarians out there. There are people who are these anti, you know, global warming, anti-climate change, all this other stuff saying it just doesn't exist. And you've sort of done a remarkably good job in terms of just saying, look, dismissing these people more or less, just like, look, you can't pay attention to a bunch of clowns out here that are doing whatever. But you've spoken about how scientists are actually the real skeptics, and that lends even greater strength to the report, that the science behind this report and the dire situations facing humanity in relation to global warming, real and accurate. While it's the scientists are skeptics in terms of how they carry this stuff out, how they develop all this, this stuff, they are not agnostic, and that this is actually true.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And there are individuals and groups, many of them associated with fossil fuel interests or, you know, the Koch brothers who fund a lot of these front groups that exist to try to poison the discussion of climate change, that exist to try to promote misinformation, disinformation, denial of the basic science of climate change. A lot of that is manufactured. It's well organized. It's funded by special interests like the Koch brothers through organizations like, you know, so-called Americans for Prosperity, et cetera. And in my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, I talk about my experiences at the center of the attacks from those organizations, those institutions who worked hard to try to discredit this iconic graph that I published a decade and a half ago, the so-called hockey stick curve. It became sort of an icon in the climate change debate because it very clearly demonstrated the unprecedented nature of recent warming. And because of that, it became an object of attack for those looking to discredit the science. I became an object of attack myself, and I tell my story in the book. But one of the things I also talk about in the book is the issue of scientific skepticism. In fact, I have a chapter called A Candle in the Dark, and it's an homage to Carl Sagan's wonderful book, The Demon-Haunted World, A Candle in the Dark, where Sagan talks about true scientific skepticism, and he distinguishes it sharply from pseudo-skepticism, from contrarianism, from denial. You know, people who reject the overwhelming scientific consensus about climate change aren't being skeptical. If you look at their arguments, the basis of their rejection of the mainstream science is the flimsiest of arguments that don't stand up to even the slightest bit of scientific scrutiny. Now, that's not skepticism. That's the opposite of skepticism. but they'll often try to wear the mantle of skepticism. They'll try to present themselves as modern-day Galileos, when, in fact, I think it's Sagan in his book says something to the effect that, yes, you know, they did laugh at Galileo, but they also laughed at Bozo the Clown. And you know what? You guys aren't Galileo. So you have that. And I think a lot of that is becoming increasingly marginalized, as it should, in the discussion. And climate change deniers aren't quite getting the voice that they once did. Some media organizations are doing a better job and not falling prey to sort of the fallacy of false balance, where, you know, if you're going to talk about the, you know, the latest developments in planetary science, you don't invite somebody from NASA and somebody from the Flat Earth Society and have a debate. You know, that's not the way it works. And it shouldn't work that way in climate science either, because the scientific community has reached a very strong consensus. The problem's real. It's caused by us. There's a worthy debate to be had about what to do about this problem. That's where, what we should be discussing. And interestingly enough, just earlier today, there was a report that China has now agreed to a cap-and-trade scheme. So now the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases in terms of aggregate emissions, they're lower than the U.S. in terms of per capita emissions, but the world's largest emitter, China, has now committed to cutting its greenhouse gas emissions through a cap-and-trade scheme. It really means that other countries like us have no excuse. We can't point to China and say, well, they're not doing anything about this problem. So let's have that discussion. But as far as the science is concerned, the scientists, as you say, true scientists who are skeptical recognize that there are things that are understood and relatively well settled, and that includes the fact that we're warming the planet and changing the climate, and that it is a problem if we don't do something about it. And there are other things that are still uncertain, and we're still trying to work out. We're still trying to understand, for example, how precisely climate change is going to impact phenomena like hurricanes and tornadoes. We still don't know the answer to that problem. We don't know yet exactly how climate change is going to influence the El Nino phenomenon. And that's really important, because El Nino, as you know, living on the West Coast, has a profound influence from year to year on rainfall on the West Coast. It has a profound influence on regional weather patterns around the world. And so if we want to be able to make projections of changing weather patterns that stakeholders can take into account as they build adaptation strategies, we need to be able to better answer some of those questions. And so there's a broad area of research questions in climate science where scientists like myself and my many colleagues are still working actively to figure these things out. What drives science, what's interesting to us scientists, isn't what's already known. It's the anomalies. It's the things that don't fit and understanding them. In fact, I have a section in my book, It's the Anomalies, Stupid, because that's really what drives scientific curiosity, is not showing the other guy was right, showing, yeah, everybody got this right. It's figuring out the thing that nobody else has yet been able to figure out. And that's driven intrinsically by skepticism and critical sort of assessments of scientific developments. So true scientists, true good scientists, are real skeptics. But the people who often try to pass themselves off as skeptics in the world of climate change denial are no such thing at all. They're the opposite of skeptics. They're contrarians. They're deniers. They are purveyors of pseudoscience.
And on that note, Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Just a fascinating discussion, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Always happy to come back.
Okay. Take care now.
Okay. You too. Bye.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Professor Michael Mann, the Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we've been talking about the UN report that was leaked to a number of various press agencies, the report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. Ride with the devil, hide with the law.
pistol, ain't got no sword. I got no army, ain't got no land. Ain't got nothing but the stone that's in my hand.
All right, Stone in My Hand, Everest. It's a great song. Someday we'll play the entire song. Right now, though, I'm really eager to get into this next segment of the show. In 2005, a large number of unions, associations, and other organizations in Palestine called for a movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And that's the BDS, to build up international support for three demands: end the Israeli occupation and dismantle the wall, full equality for Palestinians within Israel, and respect for the Palestinians' right of return to their land and property. And the movement has grown to become an international movement of many dimensions over the years. Joining us to talk about this is Anna Baltzer. Anna is a national organizer with the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, a coalition of over 400 groups and organizations which works on the BDS movement in the U.S. She is an award-winning lecturer, author, and activist for Palestinian human rights, and the author of Witness in Palestine, A Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. What more do people need to know about the BDS movement? Where did it come from? What are its actual goals, and what does it do?
So the goals are, as you outlined, BDS will stop once Israel abides by the most basic forms of granting justice to the Palestinian people and abiding by international law, by ending its occupation of lands occupied in 1967, full equality for Palestinian citizens in Israel, and, of course, the internationally inscribed right of return for Palestinian refugees. And this BDS movement has been incredibly successful and is incredibly powerful and really has brought a new level of U.S. organizing. It takes something that has maybe felt very far away for people in the U.S. and made it something local. This is not about looking overseas and criticizing. This is about looking at our own complicity as Americans, as taxpayers, when our U.S. government gives Israel billions of dollars a year to continue what it's doing. People can look at the nearby Boeing factory and know that Boeing was a major, very complicit company in Israel's latest massacre in Gaza, killing more than 2,100 people. This is about ending our complicity in order to support the Palestinian struggle for freedom, justice, and equality. And it's something that everybody can be a part of. There are actually groups that our organization works with, member organizations of the U.S. campaigns, groups like BDS, Students for Justice in Palestine, Code Pink, Jews for Peace, Women in Black. These are organizations working near you locally to end complicity with Israel's occupation and apartheid policies.
Let me ask you this, Anna. Let's parse this out a little bit, because the BDS movement, let's talk about the separate ingredients in it, because it's really intriguing to me the way that that has all come together. Divestment seems to be something that's very hot, and especially in terms of sort of reawakening a campus political life with a more radical edge to it, with an edge that's actually looking at things that's sort of like, we don't accept the world the way it is, and we're going to demand that something be done about it. And divestment seems to have been a big front in all this. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. Particularly on campuses, also in faith communities, we've worked very hard to support both such initiatives, most recently with the Presbyterian Church of the United States voting to divest from companies that are complicit in the Israeli occupation. And divestment is a time-honored tactic that's been used in other struggles, notably, of course, in the anti-apartheid movement during apartheid in South Africa, of institutions deciding to no longer invest in companies complicit with actions that they disagree with. And it goes hand in hand with boycott, something done either on a consumer level, or there's, of course, cultural and academic boycott. And then, of course, the official sanctions, which is done generally by government. These three sort of work together to end all aspects of complicity. Southern California has been really a center of divestment activity. It has inspired people around the country and around the world.
One of the things I was going to ask you about, the campuses in particular have been, as I was saying, very, very important in all this. And there's also been some pushback as well. I mean, we had Professor William Robinson on our show last week talking about even his daring to present course material. And frankly, stuff that people could read or not read, it was optional. There was a big assault on him. And then you have Stephen Saleta in Champaign and what's happened with him, where for tweeting some things during the horrible genocidal war against Gaza, he decides he's tweeting some things to actually take a stand with the Palestinian people. And he's basically suddenly loses a job he was promised. You see these things, the complicity between the university officials, the government, and then the various forces that are hired by the Zionist regime to come in there. How does that dynamic work out?
Well, I would say that the energy and effort that's being expended to crack down on people speaking up and on legitimate efforts to end complicity with Israel's occupation and apartheid policies, the amount of organizations and money being invested in countering these things really just speaks to the power of BDS, that perhaps more than anything else, certainly more than lip service from Obama or UN resolutions even, BDS is truly changing the discourse. BDS is threatening the status quo in a way that makes Israel and its supporters very scared, because people are no longer accepting the line that Israel is a victim or that this is something that Israelis and Palestinians should work out themselves. It's bringing home the struggle in a really powerful way. And I think the opposition is very afraid, and they should be.
You know, one of the things, Anna, and let me remind listeners first, that we are talking with Anna Baltzer, she's a national organizer with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, and she works on the BDS campaign as part of that. Now, Anna, it's very interesting to me when we talk about this stuff and what's happening with this, because there is a situation where you have all these different aspects that flow into one another, and you were just saying about people are no longer actually only left with looking at what Israel says, what the U.S. says, or whatever. But you yourself had a really interesting experience in terms of how you got to this, and you don't have to go through a whole thing. But I thought the idea that here you were, someone who went along, never questioned the official story until you actually gained some experience and were moved to look into this. And I thought that was really compelling and interesting for people to find out about. Can you talk a little bit about your own background and how you came to this?
Sure. I loved traveling, and I was living in Turkey at the time. This was now more than 10 years ago, and backpacked through the Middle East and met for the first time, knowingly at least, Palestinians. And it was through my friendships with the Palestinians that I met that I began to hear a very different version of what was happening in Israel, Palestine, from anything I'd ever heard or learned growing up as a Jewish American. And it prompted me to want to go and see for myself, because it was hard to believe all the things I was hearing. And sure enough, witnessing for myself on the ground what was happening in Palestine really rerouted my entire life to want to speak out against these things and want to support Palestinians in their struggle for freedom, justice, and equality. And actually, the things that I witnessed, my journey, are in my book, Witness in Palestine, which is actually just in the past couple of months, we've come out with a new version of it, updated and revised. I'll actually have copies that I'll be signing at a conference that's coming up by the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation in Southern California. In 2 weeks from today, it begins. It's our annual conference, September 19th to 20th. Now, I think it's our 13th conference. It's the first time it's happened on the West Coast, and so we're very excited for folks to be able to come. It's a moment to be able to network with activists around the country who are working on this issue, for more than 400 organizations around the country to be able to have a time to connect with each other, to learn more about BDS campaigns and how to implement them effectively, to learn about joint struggle and finding the points of intersectionality with other progressive causes. So I really encourage folks to check it out. You can go to our website, endtheoccupation.org/conference2014.
Okay, and another question I have for you is this. Let's talk a little bit about the cultural boycott, the academic and cultural boycott, but in particular, the cultural boycott. Recently, there was two stellar people in both worlds in terms of their moral stand, Bishop Desmond Tutu and then Roger Waters. People are really touchy about this. A lot of artists that you're surprised by when you see them going to Israel to perform in the face of calls to boycott Israel and to boycott any of this kind of a thing that could be or is actually not just construed, but is actually showing objectively support for the Israeli regime and what it's doing in the world. Can we talk about the boycott aspect of this a little bit?
Absolutely. So cultural and academic boycott, which are different, of course, but they can be grouped in certain ways, are some of, I think, the most widely misunderstood aspects of BDS, but really, I think, some of the most powerful. And in many ways, cultural and academic boycott get at sort of Israel's weak spot, and I can talk a bit about that. But I encourage people, you can go to PACSI.org, that stands for the Palestinian Campaign for Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel.org, to read the full call and about some of the nuances. But in 2004, Palestinians, or before the BDS call, actually, Palestinians came out with this call to say that cultural and academic institutions in Israel, as well as when American performers, for example, go over to Israel, that these institutions, while many of us may perceive them as somehow separate from politics, that they are part and parcel of Israel's occupation and apartheid policies. They're deeply complicit in furthering Israel's aggression towards Palestinians in a whole myriad of ways that I could talk about if you wanted, and that if we are to end our complicity in Israel's aggression, it includes ending complicity with Israeli cultural and academic institutions, as well as ending our personal U.S. or wherever one might be complicity with those with Israel's aggression. So, for example, it would include if a U.S. performer was going over to Israel, that sends a message by performing in Israel. It sends the message that Israel is a normal country, that we have business as usual with Israel, but there should be no business as usual with an apartheid state. Likewise, with academic partnerships, for example. And it's important to note that cultural and academic boycott apply very specifically to institutional ties. They do not apply to individuals. This is not a boycott of individuals. It's a boycott of institutional links to Israel's occupation and apartheid policies. And truly, these types of campaigns have had a profound effect. When I mentioned them being Israel's weak spot, that Israel cares very much about its perception within the cultural and academic world. And to not be invited to take part in academic partnerships, to have a performer decide not to go and play a concert in Israel, that truly actually touches the lives and disrupts the business as usual in Israel in a way that, many of our other campaigns have not been able to do. So I encourage people to learn more about and get active in. It's a really important thing to learn more about.
All right. And one more question, Anna, and we'll have to be real quick with this. But what can we look forward to in terms of what's coming up right now? I mean, you're at a pretty important spot in time where you have, one, there's still the continuing aggression against the Palestinians in Gaza in many different forms. And I doubt very much that it's over, you know. And you also have the opening up of campuses across the country. What can people look forward to? And then also, beyond any individual area, how can people anywhere, if they want to get in touch with this, with people working on this BDS campaign, again, give them the information to do that. But let's talk about this. What can we look forward to as we open up in the you know the new school year, the developments in the world? How about that?
Absolutely. Well, as a national organizer working specifically on BDS campaigns, I can say that it is unbelievable to see the campaigns that are coming out all around the country. Too many to keep track of, too many to even follow. To follow even the victories is difficult at this point. Things are moving so quickly. It's a very exciting movement to be a part of. Absolutely, I expect that with this new school year, we will see more and more divestment campaigns unfolding around the country, around the world. Church campaigns are continuing, divestment campaigns there in that realm. And really all of the things that we've talked about are growing exponentially. So it's an amazing moment to get involved in this struggle. We have a campaign going at the U.S. campaign to hold Israel accountable, to make sure that Israel does not get away with its massacre of the people of Gaza over this past summer. And people can find out more about that and sign the petition at holdisraelaccountable.org. And in general, I encourage people to get in touch to learn more about BDS. You can go to the BDS Movement's website, bdsmovement.net, and also to visit our website, endtheoccupation.org, where you can find out more information about BDS, about other campaigns to hold Israel accountable, and especially to find out more information about our conference beginning in 2 weeks, where I hope to meet some of the listeners.
All right, Anna, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon. Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Anna Baltzer, a national organizer with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation and an organizer with the BDS movement. And if you're interested in that website that Anna mentioned earlier in the interview, it's the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and the site is PACBI.org, all right? PACBI.org. That's where you can find out all kinds of information about the academic and cultural boycott. I also want to remind people again, two important announcements that I made at the beginning of the show. The first one is, pay attention now, okay? The first one is, don't lose sight of September 21st, all right? That's the day when many thousands of people all over the country are going to be out in the streets demonstrating around the climate crisis, okay? I just want to make sure everybody knows about that and is spreading the word about that. And very important, the announcement I made about a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person. The dialogue is Revolution and Religion, the Fight for Emancipation, and the Role of Religion. A dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person, November 15th, 2014, 3 to 7 p.m. at the Riverside Church. All right, and it's a historic dialogue on a question of great importance in today's world between the revolutionary Christian Dr. Cornel West and the revolutionary communist leader Bob Avakian. Don't miss this one. Wherever you are, let's get as many people as we can to New York City for that event. All right, that's going to be really important. And if you can't get to New York, I'm sure there'll be ways that can be figured out to access that, to have access to it some way. After all, this is a time when, we've got all kinds of internet technology. We've got all kinds of recording devices. We've got all kinds of things going on. Let's figure out how this can be something commensurate with its importance in the world today. All right. So if you want to find out more information about this, go to revcom.us. That's revcom.us. And you'll find out all kinds of information about it. But don't miss this one. This is going to be an earth shaker and a world changer. All right. So stay tuned on that. So that just about brings us to the end of another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State University and Anna Baltzar from the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do so on Twitter and Facebook. Always pleasant to do that, all right? But just do it very carefully so you don't freak me out, okay? And when I hear footsteps and they get loud behind me, I really do get scared, all right? So let's not do that. All right, we're going to go out now with a song that I've been addicted to for the last couple of weeks, and it's called The Messenger Speaks, all right? And it's by a group called Savage Rose, which was really a killer band, and I'm just going to play this out as far as I can just because it's such a damn good song. Let's listen to The Messenger Speaks, all right? Talk to you again next week.